Our sense of security certainly got a big shaking when the planes hit the buildings on September 11th, 2001. Nothing like it had ever happened on American soil. Thousands of civilians dead from terrorist bombs. But terrorist bombings are nothing new in America. Today's guest wrote a book about a period in our history in the late 60s and early 70s when bombings were a regular occurrence. They claimed few victims, but certainly raised concerns in police and society about a radical left wing getting out of control. Brian Burroughs' book is Days of Rage, America's Radical Underground, the FBI, and the Forgotten Age of Revolutionary Violence. Brian Burrough won awards for excellence in financial journalism in his days at the Wall Street Journal. He's written five earlier books, including The Big Rich and Public Enemies. He's currently a special correspondent at Vanity Fair. Brian Burrough, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Real pleasure to be here. Thanks.
You tell us at the outset, this was a very difficult project, and you almost abandoned it. Why?
I did. I had thought, perhaps naively, that much of this I would be able to learn from government documents, from FBI files, and the like. I'd had a lot of luck with an earlier book called Public Enemies doing that. In fact, for a variety of reasons, I found that the FBI's case files on groups like the Weather Underground and the Symbionese Liberation Army were generally not available or so heavily redacted as to be just unusable to an historian. And so I fell back on kind of the basic reporting skills that I learned at the Wall Street Journal many years ago and started tracking down people and asking for interviews. And it was a little bit difficult. You know, you call people, hi, my name is Brian Burr. I don't happen to be a radical. You don't know me from Adam. Would you tell me about that building you bombed in 1974? You know, I mostly got hung up on. But eventually I realized that the difficulty was an indication of how unknown, how untold many of these stories and much of this period has been, and it kind of whetted my appetite. And the finished book is an awful lot of new material, and I'm well, frankly, proud of it.
It's a 500-page plus book, so a big and a thorough and comprehensive look at that time. I'm curious about the redactions in the FBI files. I wonder why to this day they would still be so heavily marked up.
I share your wonderment. Look, some of these cases, the vast majority of the bombings that we're talking about were what you might call protest bombings, many of them in the Bay Area, as a matter of fact. Bombings of empty buildings late at night with warnings called in. Less than 1% of the underground bombings of the 1970s caused a fatality. But some did, and some of these cases remain open to this day.
So I am struck by those numbers. One, the number of bombings, and two, the number of people hurt, which is not a big figure.
No, the number that people have fixated on the book so much is the FBI count of 2,500 separate bombings, many of them by radical groups, during 1971 and 1972, which just seems amazing to us now, because after 9/11, a bombing to us means a situation in which people die. And in the 1970s, by and large, that was not the case. Yes, people did die, but that was the exception rather than the rule. The bombings that began with the Weather Underground in early 1970, late 1969, you know, they went on throughout the 70s. One of my favorite quotes was from the head guy in the FBI in San Francisco in 1976, who called the Bay Area the Belfast of North America.
Wow, which probably really strikes people who might have lived in the Bay Area at the time a little oddly.
Well, it is a little odd, because when we think Belfast, we think about sectarian violence, and most of the bombings that you're talking about, let's just take the Bay Area, which was beset by not only the Weather Underground, but a group, a little remembered group called the New World Liberation Front, which detonated something like 95 bombs in the Bay Area up until its dissolution in late 1970. Yet even if you lived in San Francisco, you certainly were not living in fear of the New World Liberation Front. Most of these bombs went off outside courthouses late at night against dozens of PG&E transformers, and inevitably there would be a communique the next day protesting some aspect of local government or the American condition. And I think by and large, most people in the Bay Area were kind of able to laugh it off, as serious as it was, because it didn't have an oppressive, overbearing feeling, you know, on your actual daily life.
Which then raises the question of either informedness or intent. I mean, were the bombers bad at their work, or did they just not intend to kill people?
No, they did not intend to kill people. Now, you can't say that all the time. The Weather Underground set out, in fact, to target policemen. The Black Liberation Army, which was the second group that went underground, did exactly the same thing. Of course, the Symbionese Liberation Army assassinated the superintendent of the Oakland schools before most of them were killed in a police shootout. So there was no shortage of actual violence. But let's say of all the bombings and shootouts, probably less than 5 or 10% caused serious injury or death.
And in fact, you refer to these as exploding news releases. Is that maybe a little broad?
Well, that's exactly what most of these were. You know, if you set off a small bomb at a courthouse or a post office late at night, and nobody knows about it, did it actually happen? Well, it did if you put out a press release the next day, and that's what these groups inevitably did. And it became so much a part of life in the largest American cities, especially the Bay Area, New York and Chicago, that people just didn't see it as a kind of a danger. One of my favorite quotes in the books was elicited by the great New York writer Pete Hamill, who after a bombing in New York in 1977 asked a bystander what she thought about it. And she said, "Oh, another bombing? Who is it this time?" Hard to imagine that type of attitude today.
Well, and it seems like even the news coverage at the time wasn't particularly comprehensive. And a couple of these stories, you refer to the guys looking at the newspaper and finding just a couple of paragraphs on page 6 or something.
If you go back and look at the news coverage of these bombings in the 1970s, there was almost never any type of expression of outrage. You're exactly right.
Wow. Brian Burroughs, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Days of Rage, America's Radical Underground, the FBI, and the Forgotten Age of Revolutionary Violence. We'll come back and talk more about this period in the late 60s and early 70s with Brian. We'll take your phone calls and emails as well. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Brian Burroughs, special correspondent at Vanity Fair, the author of 6 books. His latest one is Days of Rage, America's Radical Underground, the FBI, and the Forgotten Age of Revolutionary Violence. Primarily a lot of bombings in the late 60s and early 70s, somewhere on the order of 2,500 different bombings from the likes of the Weather Underground, the Black Liberation Army, and other groups detailed in this very big and comprehensive book. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 anywhere in the listening area, 800-838-3760, or by email jx@jeffnet.org. So despite the volume, just the sheer numbers of bombings, we've already pointed out that there were not many victims of these, not many people hurt or killed, which obviously I don't want to minimize the fact that people did die in some of these actions. But there was not a response, it seems anyway, even close to the post 9/11 response. No Patriot Act, no passage of major. Well, there actually was some passage of legislation, as you point out.
Well, there was a real, I think, dichotomy between public reaction and government reaction. The public, by and large, did not get terribly worked up about this because many of these bombings were not targeting the public. The government, however, did, as beginning with the Nixon administration, which, convened the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover, the CIA, and essentially, put every available asset toward chasing first the Weather Underground and later some of these other groups. They were spectacularly ineffective in large part because they had very little experience going undercover in kind of a commune-like milieu, any type of thing where people from the protest movement were prevalent. The FBI just had not learned how to function there. And ultimately, of course, the FBI was engulfed the FBI in a spectacular scandal in the late 1970s when it was shown how thoroughly they had embarked on a series of illegal break-ins, illegal mail openings, illegal just about everything you can imagine in pursuit of the Weather Underground.
And this was the COINTELPRO program you're talking about, the counterintelligence program?
Oh, this was even beyond COINTELPRO.
Really?
COINTELPRO was dirty tricks And, you know, it was one of the main things that they used against the Panthers and the Black Liberation Army. This was an entirely separate scandal that actually led to the indictment of the top three officials at the FBI, and ultimately in 1980, the conviction of two of them.
You write, Brian, of the people who were involved in these acts on the radical left as having misplaced idealism, naivete, and stunning arrogance. I mean, did they really think they could change minds with these procedures?
Oh, absolutely. The first people that began going underground in 1970, the Weathermen, and to a large extent, almost everybody who went underground in 1970 sincerely believed, after the kind of in the spirit of 1968, that a second American Revolution actually was imminent, and that violence would speed the change. I quote a number of people saying, "Yeah, we thought the revolution was coming in like, I don't know, 75, 76, 77," and you know, it seems outlandish from a vantage point of 45 years that people believe that. But in fact, if you went through the 60s, if you lived through 1968, if you saw governments toppling in country after country after country, it was easy to believe that an actual new world order was beginning. And having seen what Mao did in China with a small group of people at the beginning, what Ho Chi Minh did in North Vietnam, and especially what Fidel and Che Guevara did in Cuba, the Weathermen and these other groups legitimately believed that a small group of dedicated underground leftists could initiate an actual revolution.
So let's talk about 1968 at a greater length, because I think people lose sight of the fact that sometimes the fact that this country was roiled by a lot of demonstrations and protests and peace marches and a lot of uprising in general. It happened in a lot of other places as well. So, I mean, why 1968? Why in places like Czechoslovakia and France and the many other countries that experienced this?
It happened because it happened. You know, it was clearly beginning in the early 1960s. You can see it in the United States. There was a degree of generational ferment, which was met by an older generation that saw no need to change. And as the marches against civil rights and eventually against the Vietnam War mounted in the mid-60s, you know, the people out in the streets were not seeing the type of change, systemic change, that they sought, either in their government, in the persecution, in the war, or especially in the treatment of African Americans. And so it was very much that disappointment, that frustration, that caused a number of them, a minority to be sure, but still enough to cause a lot of havoc, to begin going underground in 1970 in hopes that violence could succeed where protest in the streets had not.
Was the frustration sharpened that much more by the election of Richard Nixon in 1968 as president?
Absolutely, because Nixon came into office in large part on the promise that he would crack down on these long-haired kids in the street.
Oh, that's right, the Law and Order campaign, yeah.
Exactly right. And, you know, it's important to recognize something that may be difficult for younger listeners who came of age after 9/11 to realize these people who were detonating bombs in the 1970s, they were not the Unabomber. They were not crazy, insane people. The things that they were angry about were legitimate grievances. The Nixon administration really was as corrupt as they said. The war was misguided. There had been centuries of neglect and oppression of African Americans. The astonishing part is just that they felt that they had to resort to political violence, bombings, assassinations, to speed that change, when in the wake of 9/11, I think in America, by and large, we have wholly rejected the idea of giving any credibility to political violence, and we had not done that in the 70s.
Brian Burrow is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Days of Rage. Let's start a little more specifically about some of the people here. The dynamite in the refrigerator that you mentioned here, which, you know, is a pretty interesting picture, but ultimately not terribly funny. Who and where?
Well, the very first group to start an actual kind of protest bombing campaign was led by a young militant named Sam Melville, who began detonating bombs around Manhattan in late 1969. This group was active between August and November of 1969 when they were all arrested. Melville himself was ultimately killed in the prison rebellion at Attica in September 1971. Before Sam Melville came along, Political violence was almost, there was plenty of it, but it was mostly Molotov cocktails thrown by college kids at ROTC buildings at night. Melville, who famously hid his dynamite in his refrigerator, was the first to begin building larger bombs and to detonate them against courthouses and the Department of the Army and major symbols of American power. And he was actually out there doing it a matter of weeks, 2 months before the Weathermen, the first major group, followed in his footsteps just a couple months later.
We already had a drop-off question by a listener who wanted to know if any of the bombings were done by the government that you were able to find out.
No. Yeah. No, I mean, if you're looking for government bombings, they were in Vietnam and Laos and Cambodia. That's what someone, perhaps in sympathy with Weatherman or the SLA or the Black Liberation Army, would point out.
All right, and you point out in the book that a typical view of the post Woodstock uprising, when these bombings all began to get common, is that this is a bunch of hippies, which is probably the way Nixon characterized it too. You say no, and you've already given a hint that these were not Unabomber types. Who were they?
They were, by and large, hardcore leftists. They were revolutionary communists. Every single group was in some way Marxist, pro-Cuban, inspired by the Cuban Revolution. I'm not here to condemn it or condone it. It is what it is. And this was certainly not the radical left's finest chapter in their long and colorful history in the United States. These were groups, by and large, that wanted to replace the American government with a communist government.
You focus a lot of attention on Weatherman. We talked about Weatherman, Weather Underground. First, why that name? Where did that come from? Do we know?
From a name from Bob Dylan's song, "You Don't Need a Weatherman to Know Which Way the Wind Blows."
And then second, it sounds like the Weatherman filled something of a radical power vacuum.
They did. The Weathermen were a spinoff of the dominant 60s protest group called SDS, the Students for a Democratic Society. Many of them were Ivy Leaguers. They were smart. They were really the leaders of some of the major sectors of the movement of the 1960s. And when they went underground, they became the largest and I think most significant of the underground groups. They ultimately lasted 6 or 7 years. However, their reality, their history, has always been kind of cloaked in a deep shadow. Many of its alumni, especially probably its best-known alumnus, Bill Ayers, has always insisted that they only did protest bombings, bombing empty buildings and courthouses late at night and never hurt a soul. In fact, I think we demonstrate in the book that this is not true, that in fact the Weather Underground initially set out to target policemen and military officers in installations. And they only gave up that tactic when, unfortunately, one of their early bombs managed to blow up and kill three of their own members, at which they essentially lost the stomach for murderous violence and embarked on this type of protest bombing campaign that Ayers describes.
We're talking to Brian Burrow, who is a special correspondent at Vanity Fair and the author of several books, including his latest one, Days of Rage, America's Radical Underground, the FBI, and the Forgotten Age of Revolutionary Violence. We're talking about the late 60s and early 70s here, and you can join us at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area, 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Specifically to life circumstances, we're not talking about poverty-stricken, starving artists here, from the sounds of it.
Not the Weather Underground. These people lived in a variety of circumstances over the decade of the 70s. The Weather Underground, if you go back and pick up one or two of these memoirs that some of them written, you would think that they just lived hellish lives in the ghetto. In fact, I was able to determine, in fact, that Bill Ayers and Bernadine Dorn, who were the two principal leaders, especially on the West Coast, lived most of their time underground in a very nice beach bungalow down in Hermosa Beach. And the New York, the East Coast leadership, lived in quite a nice vacation rental up in the Catskills. So they weren't exactly roughing it. Now, that can be contrasted clearly against some of these other groups, such as the Black Liberation Army, which did live in squalor, hunted desperately by the police. So there was a wide variety of kind of experiences that you would have if you lived underground in America in the 1970s.
You mentioned Bill Ayers. I want to come back to him a bit later. Bernadine Dorn, though, emerges as a major figure here. Tell us a bit about her.
Bernadine Dorn was the queen of the underground. She was the first among equals of the weather underground. J. Edgar Hoover famously called her La Pasionara of the lunatic left. She was the person who, after this townhouse bombing in New York in March 1970, essentially took over the group or became the first among equals and ordained that they were not going to trigger an American Revolution by killing people, that they needed to be more life-affirming, that they needed to inspire rather than strike fear in people's hearts. And she remained the leader of the group throughout the 1970s until finally internal turmoil in the group led to a coup, and she was forced to say that in this amazing recording from I think it was like late 1976 that how they had purposely sabotaged the group. Anyway, she was ultimately, like most of the weather underground, was never prosecuted, never faced criminal charges, and has gone on to a very successful life as a writer and a college professor in Chicago.
And not underground.
No. She and Bill Ayers, who married and are still together, resurfaced in 1980. It's amazing to think back now. When you think of all this, you think of this as something from the 60s or maybe the early 70s. The last radical members of the underground were not captured until 1985.
Wow, so years after all these events happened. And, of course, 15 years after this blast you mentioned on West 11th Street in Greenwich Village, this is the one that killed three people, right?
That's right. This was...
But yeah. My memory, that I have my own memories of that because my father lived in Greenwich Village at the time, and he took us to see the wreckage, and I still clearly remember looking at the building next door where you could still see the standing bookcases and furniture and stuff.
Well, you know, and you know whose office that was that you could peer into.
It was Dustin Hoffman?
It was the actor Dustin Hoffman. His office desk fell into a hole caused by this explosion.
Wow. So what happened there? I mean, this was a turning point for this group, wasn't it?
It was not only a turning point for this group, but I think for the whole underground movement, if you will. There was a collective. They lived in collectives there in New York. They were planning their first serious bombing attack for that night. They had already done some Molotov cocktails and minor bombings around the city. But that night, they were building a number of dynamite bombs that they intended to detonate at an officer's dance at Fort Dix in New Jersey. And it was very clear that if this went forward, they were going to be mass murderers. And it's funny, I've interviewed several surviving members of the collective, including one of the women who crawled out of the rubble, one of the survivors, Kathy Wilkerson. And there was not a lot of extra thought or doubt or guilt. They thought they were in a revolution. They thought it was Russia in 1905, and this is what you had to do. Unfortunately, their political theorizing, their political prowess was far ahead of their technical prowess, and the young man who was running the collective and who was building the bomb, his name was Terry Robbins, he was from Kent State in Ohio, he didn't know how to build the bomb safely, and it went off in his hands. The entire building fell and killed Terry and two other people.
Wow. So at that point, they got cold feet, some of them, about moving forward with ideas about killing large amounts of people?
Exactly right. At that point, the weather underground essentially ceased to exist. Let's say they probably went underground with about 150, and they ultimately got maybe 50 of them back. Dorn and Bill Ayers and the leadership convened a meeting 2 months later in Northern California, in Mendocino, I think it is, where they kind of charted this new course of protest bombings that would not attempt to kill policemen or military officers. That much is known. Kind of the spectacular kind of new part that we can now add to that is the technical part. One of the things we do in Days of Rage, the book, is identify for the first time the young man who was the Weather Underground's bomb guru. His name is Ron Fliegelman. He's now a retired school teacher living in Brooklyn. And I approached Ron, having been told what his role was, and he cooperated extensively and talked about how they were able to build a new and safer bomb design that ultimately they taught to at least one of the other groups, as a matter of fact, that allowed the Weather Underground to continue their bombing campaign for much of the decade.
Does he have any particular regrets about his activities then?
No, he really doesn't. Ron, who I have a lot of respect for, would have you feel that it's important for people today to understand the circumstances that led these young people to launch this kind of war against America, to understand the corruption, the war, the plight of African Americans back then. He does not feel remorse. He feels like they were justified in doing what they did. And, you know, Ron also, like most of the Weather Underground, never faced political charge, any type of criminal charge. In fact, he was never publicly identified until this book.
And so, I mean, are there any statutes of limitations that that might still be broad enough to include him for any of his activities at that time?
No. By and large, if you just attack the building, you're safe. The only thing you have to worry about was if someone was killed. And there are a few of these cases that remain open, however, to this day.
The book is called Days of Rage, America's Radical Underground, the FBI and the Forgotten Age of Revolutionary Violence. Brian Burrow wrote it. He's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll come back and talk to him and take a phone call and an email when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Brian Burrow, a special correspondent at Vanity Fair, a longtime reporter for the Wall Street Journal, where he won awards for his excellence in financial journalism, and the author of now 6 books. His latest is called Days of Rage, America's Radical Underground, the FBI and the Forgotten Age of Revolutionary Violence. We're talking largely about bombings, some 2,500 bombings from about 1969 onward from the radical underground in America. Brian Burrow has put together a very comprehensive book about that, and you can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in our listening area. In the emails, you can send those to jx@jeffnet.org. We have an email here from David in Ashland. He wants to ask primarily to what degree the Weather Underground was manipulated by infiltration, if in fact the feds did manage to get people in there to guide some of their activities.
No, there's no evidence there was any of that. In fact, the feds were so wholly ineffectual. We know of precisely one informant that they were able to get into the group who, unfortunately, his cover was blown very early on when Hoover wanted to make some arrests. And the only way they could make these arrest a couple of minor members was by blowing this guy's cover. There's no evidence that the FBI ever further infiltrated the group, much less directed any of the violence.
You were talking about spending some time with Ron Fliegelman, who actually made the bombs that the Weather Underground was using more effective in the sense that they would not kill the people who were trying to make them, for example. But and then the whole concept back from the beginning of the discussion about these exploding press releases. Was there an argument about just how effective they had been if, in fact, they were getting just a few paragraphs on page 6 and just seen as part of the nighttime scene in New York City? Well, oh, geez, another government building lost a wall or a couple of windows or that sort of thing.
Yeah, barely a year into this, in a communique that they called New Morning, Weather pretty much acknowledged that things weren't going very well. And from that point on, it became an ongoing debate whether they should continue doing this. I quote any number of people in the book saying, you know, what were we going to do, keep bombing bathrooms for another 50 years? Nothing's changing. The fact was, I think these people were ultimately hemmed in by their own ambition, hemmed in by the statements they'd made before, and they stubbornly clung to this dream. After about 1971 and after about 70 and 71, they started doing fewer bombings but attempted to make them higher profile. Hence, we saw a weather bomb that went off in a toilet at the U.S. Capitol in February 1971. And then, most famously of all, they managed to get a bomb into the Pentagon in May of 1972, which I'm highly confident Ron Fliegelman built. So they kept at this as long as they could until by about 1976, they realized this revolution is not happening. The war is over. The civil rights movement has petered away, and they more or less gave up. Now, there were other groups out there, the Symbionese Liberation Army, a group called The Family that robbed banks in the New York area well into the early 80s. There were a very famous revolutionary group called the George Jackson Brigade that was very active in the mid-70s in Washington State, in addition to the New World Liberation Front, which bombed all across California during the 1970s. So the Weathermen was the first and most famous of these groups, but there were other groups less remembered that actually detonated even more bombs.
Were the Weathermen the ones responsible for a bomb at New York police headquarters?
That's right. That was their first bomb after the townhouse. It was the first of Ron Fliegelman's bombs. And it was pretty incredible because it was absolutely unprecedented that someone actually managed to smuggle a bomb into New York police headquarters. It detonated on an evening in June 1970, about 120 feet down from the commissioner's office. And, you know, it jolted East Coast society. It jolted the police. If you look back today at the kind of the legacy of the security matters that we all take for granted, whether it's bomb-sniffing dogs or metal detectors or just the basic security desk that you see in every government building now, it really began not just with the Weather Underground bombings, but with that particular bombing. That soon after, there began to be articles about security precautions going up in major government buildings around New York, and they quickly spread to Washington, D.C. as well.
There actually was some legislation that got passed, too, it sounds like, to restrict the access to explosives.
That's one of the funniest kind of unremembered things about all this is, yes, as a direct result of the Weatherman's bombings in 1970, you saw this profusion of new laws being introduced in almost every state to restrict the sale of dynamite. Keep in mind, until these laws came into effect, Ron Fliegelman was able to walk into a construction supply store in New England, I think it was in Vermont, and buy a crate of dynamite for $60 just by showing his driver's license. And within a year, certainly within 2 years, that was almost impossible to do in the United States, as it remains to this day.
We have a caller on the line. Here's Larry in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Brian Burrow, the author of Days of Rage.
Yes, good morning. I was stationed at the ROTC, University of Washington, Seattle, 70-71, early 72, and a comment on the economic status of some of these is I well remember Silas Trim Bissell and his wife Susan, who he was a member of or a grandson of the Bissell fortune for
the carpet cleaners,
cleaner
yeah.
stuff. And he got caught planting a bomb in the ROTC department there, and somebody posted him, I think, $50,000 bail, and he split and ended up going completely underground and was caught years later as a nurse in Eugene, Oregon, and went to trial at that later date. But certainly money was not an issue with Trim, and so I was supporting that these were not all just one type of person.
Yeah, thanks for the reminder there, Larry. I do remember Silas Trim Bissell getting captured or finally came to justice after I moved to Oregon, which again raises the question, Brian Burrow. I don't know if you had a chance to talk to some of the people who were really in good financial circumstances, but why they were essentially turning against the society that had nurtured their parents to riches.
They call it white skin privilege. It was the incredible guilt that a certain type of white American felt over all the outrages that we learned about that had been perpetuated against black Americans. There was a component of the white protest movement that essentially, as I quote a number of them saying in the book, wanted to be Black Panthers, wanted to expunge themselves of this guilt, this incredible sin that had been perpetuated against blacks. And yes, the caller is exactly right. Some of these people were children of great privilege. Bill Ayer's father was chairman of Commonwealth Edison in Chicago. And it's funny, as a result, it's long been speculated that it was kind of some of these wealthy families that were secretly supporting the Weather Underground among these other groups while they were doing all this. And that's one of the myths that we were able kind of to finally solve in the book. I actually interviewed any number of people from the Weather Underground, and it turns out that they got almost all their money from not only just other movement supporters, but especially a network of radical attorneys in the Bay Area, New York, and Chicago, who funneled them money, a number of whom acknowledge doing so proudly now in the book.
But there was no old family money kind of thing, other than what the kids might have had as allowance or something.
I think that it's entirely possible that that a Bill Ayers here or a Kathy Wilkerson there got money from their families. But I think by and large, they were getting money from radical attorneys.
Not clear from the first half of the book. Did Bill Ayers actually talk to you? I gather he didn't.
We went round and round via email, but at this point, no, he did not sit down for an extended interview. At this point, he's a talented enough writer that he's far more interested in writing his own stories than having somebody like me write them for him.
Is he also shy about the whole, I mean, you know, Fox News will bring up Bill Ayers in a heartbeat and connect him to Barack Obama. And certainly his name got used a lot in the first election campaign for Obama.
In a fairly silly way. Look, the one thing, whatever you think about Bill Ayers, he's brave enough. He went toe-to-toe with Fox News over more than an hour last summer, and I think stood up for himself fairly well. You know, he argues what many of them argued, that there were reasons that they did what they did. But what he really has no answer for is what I think we show in the book, and that is the idea that they started off trying to assassinate policemen and only resorted to these softer tactics after they got some of their own people killed. I told him I was going to write all that. In fact, everything kind of new that was in the book about weather, I ran by him and his attorneys, and they chose not to respond.
Are there events even today that the members of Weather Underground will not admit to?
Oh, goodness, let me think. There's so many members, it's hard to generalize.
Mm-hmm. And for that matter, was it fairly centralized, or was it a pretty scattered kind of setup?
It was very centralized, as opposed to a group like the Black Liberation Army, which pointedly didn't have a leadership. Weather really was very centralized. And I think the third rail for them is an incident that we haven't discussed, which was a bomb that went off in February of 1970, very early in their career, at a time that they were targeting police. A bomb went off on a ledge outside the Park Station police station in San Francisco and killed a San Francisco police sergeant named Brian O'Connell. Grand juries have been looking into that killing for decades, as recently as 2010. They were still requesting handwriting and speech samples from several of the Weathermen leaders, including Bernadine Dorn. I don't believe that crime will ever be solved, and I've seen compelling evidence, in fact, that it was not Weatherman that did that. But that's probably the one unsolved crime of the era in which a person was murdered that has continue to be linked to the Weather Underground.
We've mentioned the Black Liberation Army here a couple of times, which, you know, a lot of people are not, I would think, aware of the BLA nearly as much, for example, as the Black Panthers. What was their genesis?
The BLA was a violent offshoot of the Panthers, much as Weather was a violent offshoot of SDS. The amazing thing about the BLA, which assassinated, I believe it was 8 policemen in about 20 attacks, between 1971 and 1973, is that they ignited an entire national debate at the time, carried out in the pages of the New York Times about whether they even existed. The idea being that this was just a bunch of ex-Panthers and black militants, and every time they shot a cop, they claimed they were members of a Black Liberation Army so that they would sound more important, in fact, that they were. In fact, by going back and now tracking down and listening on the record interviews from some of their early leaders and soldiers, we can actually tell the story of the BLA for the first time. That, yes, it was a, whatever you may think about the wisdom of what they did, it was a credible, violent underground movement. And you can say who the members were and what they did, that's what we're able to do in the book for the first time.
We need to talk about Richard Moore, who goes by another name now. Where is he, and what name does he go by?
Richard Moore, who was one of the BLA's first organizers in spring of 1971, later changed his name to Daruba Bin Wahad. He's now 70 years old. He lives in Atlanta, and Daruba was one of the more important interviews I was able to carry out in retracing the history of the BLA. He was probably the most important organizer and he ultimately served 15 years for his role in two early attacks that the BLA carried out in New York City in May 1971 that severely injured two policemen and assassinated two others. His convictions were ultimately overturned, but DeRuba has no problem letting you understand that he was part of that. He will tell you just about everything up to when the gun was pulled, but he won't tell you where the bullet went. But it's amazing to go back, especially in light of all that's happened in America since Ferguson 9 months ago. It's amazing to go back and talk to members of the BLA about their roles in assassinating policemen in response to exactly the same things that we're hearing today, that black lives don't matter, that black men are routinely killed by white policemen. And, you know, the quote that from the book that stays with me that DeRuba gave me was, "The mistake we made was killing the cops in uniform. We should have killed the higher-ups. That would have been much more effective."
I was going to ask if there were responses within the BLA and company to what has been happening since Ferguson, and the answer is yes.
It is. It's amazing today to look at what we've experienced in the last 9 months is so similar to what the U.S. was going through, especially in the 1971 to 1973 time frame. And yet, other than a few random ad hoc moments of violence, there has been nothing like a systematic violent response as there was in the early 1970s. And I think that the reason there hasn't been that today, the reason that so many members of the left believe that this can be corrected by working within the system, by peaceful protests and peaceful marches, is they saw what left-wing violence did in America in the 1970s, and it just didn't lead to much positive change.
It is very, very well documented in Days of Rage, America's Radical Underground, the FBI, and the Forgotten Age of Revolutionary Violence. Brian Burrow wrote it and joined us today in the exchange. Brian, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good to have you.